Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another conversation. Today's conversation is pretty interesting. Today, we're going to be talking about government in general, how they run, what software they use, what technology can support them, etc. And generally, from your understanding and from my understanding of government from a process perspective, is budget, procurement, grants, payments. And for decades, most of the software that were used in government, they were built by somebody from outside the government looking in, and not necessarily from within government. So therefore, there's a lot of mismatch, I will. And here in Canada, we've got several big examples of those. The payroll system still sits in my head as a debacle, how not to install a software for government or how not to deploy software for government. So very, very familiar with that episode. So today's guest is that is an exception of this whole formula that we just laid out for you. He served as a CIO for two Florida municipalities, managing the exact same system government agencies depend on. And before crossing to the other side, to the enterprise side of the table, spending two decades in building companies that sells those systems. So he spent a couple of decades selling these systems. He has now led two GovTech companies as CEO, and today runs UNA, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, E-U-N-A, for those who are listening out there. We'll include all that information in the podcast post-edit, so you don't have to remember it. And UNA is a solutions or a government solution-oriented tech company, and North American platform serving more than 3,600 public sector organizations across the United States and Canada. UNA touches procurement, budgeting, grants, payments, special education administration, and in any given year manages hundreds of billions of dollars in public funds on behalf of communities most of us live in. So most of the communities that we live in gets touched by these budgets and by these disbursements of procurement-funded money that government spends. Named to the GovTech Top 100 2 years in running, AWS Champion, that's AWS, you guys are familiar with AWS, I don't even have to spell it out for you, Award winner of AI innovation. And three weeks ago, UNA launched what we may be the first AI tool out there that purpose built to review government RFPs before it goes out to door. Oh, this is music to my ear when I read that. RFPs with government, catching the ambiguity, the conflicting criteria, and the vague requirement that drives vendors crazy and away, mm-hmm. and kill perhaps competition before it starts. It have been on the receiving end of these RFPs, and I can tell you firsthand, we need something to fix that scenario, specifically when RFPs don't match the services that we're trying to put out there. I want to welcome my good friend, I just met you, Tom Ambergi, and I'm hoping that I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, to the conversation. Tom is the CEO of UNA, and I can't wait to get to know Tom personally and get to know UNA a little bit, get to know about your solution. To everybody listening in and coming in on the podcast, welcome to the conversation. Let's get into it. Tom, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to be here. And yeah, you got my last name right, Ambergi. Very good.
I really appreciate it, Tom, joining us. Why don't we start with this one, if you don't mind. What is your story? What got you here? If you don't mind, just give us a little bit of your background. I know I've read a little bit about your background here, but give us a little bit better, framing of your background would be great.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. I think it's interesting. Of course, it's mine. But grew up in a military family, so I am the quintessential military brat. Grew up kind of all over the U.S. I've lived on both coasts and kind of in the middle at different points in my upbringing, been primarily as an adult in the Southeast, but enjoyed learning about just life in a way that's mission driven, right? So military life, if any families that are out there that are in the military, they'll tell you the families are in the military too. A little different service and requirements, but you learn that, you know, mission comes first and service comes first. And so kind of grew up with that mindset and have really made that kind of a foundation, which is what attracted me to government and then, you know, government technology specifically. I think a little clarification on my couple decades here in services, I bookended my service as a CIO in the private sector. So I started really getting connected to government, doing software implementations. Back in Y2K, before Y2K, when everybody thought the world was going to blow up, I went to work for a little software company that had proven that they were going to survive the change. They were based, they did their software on IBM AS400 back then. They're now called iSeries, and most people probably don't even know what those are, but they had proven they were going to survive. And so they were exploding in growth. And so I got a job doing implementations and kind of fell in love with processes and learned that. And through just a series of interesting steps, went to work for government, as you said, and as you know, just blessed to serve as CIO in a couple very different municipalities. So one a little more rural, a little more affluent, lots of money to spend on technology, and expected things to really work well. And so that really enabled me to build a really nice infrastructure and do some really cool stuff. Back when Wi-Fi was coming out, we blanketed our city with Wi-Fi. We did smart meter reading, some really advanced stuff, and enjoyed that. And then my other stint was at a much more urban and a full service agency. So really tight budgets, really tight requirements, really meeting the needs of the citizenry. So learned different takes and things along the way there. And then went back into the private sector and really felt that that's the way that I could have the biggest impact and drive the mission, right? Of really understanding that really well-run governments, lots of people work really hard. I think government gets a bad rap lots of times. Sometimes they do it to themselves. We do it to ourselves, but sometimes it's a bad rap. And there's a lot of people that really care about what they're doing. And so providing them tools that make their job easier allows them to just get through the day and provide the service that they want to provide. It's really meaningful. And so that ultimately, through a couple steps, led me to UNA, and really excited to be at UNA. As you mentioned, we really focus on kind of financial services tools around budgeting, procurement, grants, money. We talk about, you know, how we're going to plan it, how we're going to spend it, and how we're going to collect it, right? Kind of that view of the financial life cycle there, and really excited. I think this year we're going to pass the $600 billion mark from amounts that are budgeted through our budgeting tools. We're gonna pass getting close to $100 billion, which go through our procurement systems and grants. We're approaching the $600 billion level of grants that are processed through our system. So those numbers alone just show the impact that we're having, and we're really excited about that.
This is very impressive. Now, my understanding from UNA perspective as a company, previously was publicly traded company, GTY Technology. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, UNA's
got it. You rebranded to UNA in May 2023, I think it was, right?
Rebranded May, June is when it kind of soft launched out. Yeah, I joined in July, and so it had rebranded just before I joined, and we've tweaked a few things, but that's the story. So it was publicly traded. It was taken private. We're backed by a very, very good private equity firm.
GI Partners, right? Is that it?
Partners, you are correct. Made some great investments and really, really good firm to work with. And they've helped us really solidify the foundation of what GTY was as it's grown into UNA. When it was GTY, it was kind of six things that have been brought together. We're now 12 different companies and products that have been brought together, consolidated, and really providing great service to our constituents.
Now, before we get into the rest of the stuff, I'm interested in the PE subject. Normally, PE firms buy companies 4 or 5 years and they move on from there. Do you see this as the play here, or do you see it more of a long-term investment? You know, they want to stick around with this business.
Yeah, I think, you know, I can't speak for them. I would say that it could be a combination of both, right? You know, all PE firms have a responsibility to return investments back. But GI historically has been one that will stay in investment for a long time, whether that's kind of reinvesting and you know, kind of call it do-overs, if you will, I think there's a really fancy name called continuation of investment vehicles, if you really get into the weeds there. So, you know, we're looking forward to a long-term partnership with GI, and whether that means, you know, there's some people that come into play with us or some other things happen, we're fine with that. We've got really good partners there. They believe in the mission. They believe in what we're trying to accomplish, both from a impact perspective as well as a business perspective, and the good things that come with it. So we anticipate being long-term partners.
Now, you've been on both sides of the table, which is, makes you very, very interesting. You were sitting in the same chair where suppliers used to pitch for you. Now the other way around. And from inside City Hall as a CIO, now running the software company, that you got to go back and sell to these people, the same people that your colleagues probably there. And I believe those two municipalities you worked in was Hellendale and Village of Wellington. Am I correct? Right. Yeah. Okay. And so what does a dual experience, you know, give you in terms of either favorability or challenges? How do you view those two in terms of leading UNA right now?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that they're both, right? I think from a favorability perspective, I can sit across from our customers or our prospective customers and tell them, you know, I get it, right? Every partner that's going to come in and say, I understand your problems. We're here for you. And if they've never worked in government, they don't really know. You can have conversations, but if you've not had to sit in front of an elected board and fight for a project, if you've not had to answer calls from constituents who are frustrated with some process or some tool or something, if you haven't been at the grocery store and someone recognizes you because they've seen you on TV and they come up and they say, why don't you guys fix this, even though you don't have any control over it, like things like that. Like if you've never sat and I say, you really don't understand. And so I can sit across from the table and legitimately tell them, I understand the pressures. I understand the needs. I understand the desire to innovate when you really don't have the funds to innovate. I understand the demand where elected officials come in and they want to move at a certain pace, but don't provide the opportunities, whether it's through funding or through process, to really innovate at that pace, and the puts and takes with that. So I can honestly sit and say, I get it. Conversely, I can talk to my people about that, right? And make sure that they are well-versed in the struggles and well-versed in the processes. Like we don't push for processes that aren't realistic. Like we don't put things out there that we know can't happen. We work with our partners and we truly try to build that partnership. And I'm able to sometimes be that voice of reason, if you will, between both sides in terms of being able to connect the dots about things that we want to accomplish as a business and things we need to accomplish as a business, but more importantly, make it so that it works and flows within the government context and works where they're. You know, some of the challenges are I can get frustrated. I worked in government, so my frustration of sometimes wanting, I was a government technologist, so wanting to push the envelope, and I see my counterparts in private sector who are buying all the new cool toys and getting little slush funds to be able to test out things and not being able to do that. You know, I can have that same frustration internally because maybe we would want to move our business ahead a little faster, but we've got to move at the pace of our customers. And that there's always a good tension there of we want to help kind of pull our customers along and help them with that innovation journey. We can't do it too fast. If we get out too far, then it's not going to work. And so that tension still exists.
Now, in the U.S., you know, selling to government, talk to us a little bit about the process of selling to government. How much lobbying there would be versus building relationships, long-term relationships with some of your colleagues on the government side? You know, what is the process like? Do you wait for an RFP? Can they buy directly? How do they buy?
Yeah, it's all of the above, right? So there is a variety of ways to work within the government. A lot of it has to do with the expense. How much are you actually spending? How much is your product? Most of our products are within a price range where there's some form of competitive procurement needed, right? And so competitive procurement means an RFP process, or there are usually kind of workarounds to that. So if you build really good relationships and you know it's a perfect fit and the customer feels comfortable with it and they feel like they're going to pick you no matter what, and you're offering competitive prices. So there's contracting vehicles, there's contracting companies. So, you know, SHI, Carahsoft, big ones that are work nationally. Some states like Texas have some procurement vehicles that they've built as a state, and they do some pseudo competitive processes to set pricing. And anybody within the state of Texas can buy off that contract without doing their own RFP. There's things like the Western States Competitive Alliance, and there's others. So there's a bunch of opportunities out there where people have tried to streamline and try to make it easy to purchase for a government so they don't have to spend. RFPs are expensive. They're expensive for the government. They're expensive for the vendor. And so if that can be avoided, we try to do that. Lobbying side, not a lot of lobbying at the local level. You see an uptick at the state level. Most of that happens at federal. We do all of our work at the state and local level. And I would probably
So you don't do federal, Tom? Or
We do not do federal currently. It's a different animal from a just totally business perspective. A lot of custom software in the federal space, a lot of requirements that are heavy, not the least of which is a FedRAMP certification for software, which can cost into the hundreds of thousands to get and maintain. And so it creates some price constraints and some resource constraints. And, you know, we look at it from our idea of having impact. We think we can have the most impact at the state and local level. And so that's what we go after. So I'd say overall, we do our share of RFPs. We do our share of selling through these contracts. And it's all about relationships.
Interesting. When you were a customer of DemandStar and Questica while you were a local government, and these two products now became Una.
Yeah.
You guys own them now. Did you ever imagine you end up running the company that built them?
No, it wasn't. When I was doing that work, and those guys were partners with us in Wellington, I didn't have any vision of going back into the private sector at that time. I thought I was going to be a lifer, and loved the job, had great flexibility, raising our kids in a really good place, and just as kind of time went on, the kids grew up, and I got a little antsy to try to do some things and try some things, and never thought they would come back around to that level though.
Now, let's get into it a little bit more on the, what does the actual community, UNA community look like? If you don't mind, Tom, paint me a picture of what the community look like when UNA is running well. What does the city actually experience that it could not before? What's it like?
Yeah, I think there's a level of what people get out of UNA, no matter what product of ours they're using. And then there's a level that says when you use more than one of our products, kind of added value or added look. And so if you think about just what do you get for a UNA partner? One is you get top-notch technology. We are number one, number two in the market for all of our products, which includes the budgeting suites, the procurement suites, the grants suites, our payment suite. Like we're top. So you're getting time-tested, proven products that work across the U.S. and Canada that have figured out the localization piece, like that that don't require heavy customization, right? We're a configuration shop for the most part. We have some customization for our top level guys, but for the most part, it's all about configuration. So you can get something out of the box, you can get it up and running relatively quickly. We are a group of 700 professionals spread out across the US and Canada who I would say maybe 30% have worked in government themselves. And so a lot of our customer facing people have been there, done that, and they're well versed in the needs of the customer, the what they can experience of our products. And so if you think about the relationship, you get a relationship where it's high touch, very good experience from whether you call in, you email in, use our systems, and then you get really good products. And that rolls down to kind of how does it look based on what you're doing. From a budget perspective, you're looking at if you're managing the budget, so you're in the finance office, the budget office, you're getting great opportunities to do scenario planning. You're getting great opportunities to automate all of your workflows out to every agency and every employee that needs to provide input to the budget. You're getting great consolidation. Every one of our customers that uses our budget tool to the fullest wins all of their awards, gets everything certified, has no issue with any problems with their budget at the end of the day. We've just recently, as much as about a year ago, launched our open budget book product, which allows them to publish their budget out publicly, to take feedback, to do searches across it. So you're enabling your constituents to participate and to understand where the money's going and where their taxes are going, and ask questions and do it openly and transparently with the push of a button. So again, reduce workflows, reduce the ease of use. We're hosting all of it, making it easy. I could have the same thing for procurement, same thing for grants, right? It's all about how we automate workflows, how we simplify and streamline the work, how we make it transparent. We talk at UNA about there's a reason we exist. And we don't talk about mission vision. We talk about existence, and we exist to build trust and enable transparency in all of our communities. And so when we think about our communities, our customers are one set of communities. And so we want to build trust. And so everything we do, we're going to act a certain way. We're going to speak a certain way, but primarily we're going to tell the truth and we're going to act with integrity. And then we're going to be transparent and build tools that enable them to be transparent. Is that's always the ask. If you go across anybody, particularly in the US, and I think the same is true if you talk to anybody in Canada, One of the biggest things they want from government is transparency. Everyone thinks government hides stuff. Everyone thinks government's a black hole. They want it to be transparent.
They can't hide things. They're on TikTok now.
Now they're on TikTok. You're right. It's getting harder and harder, no doubt. But we want tools to make that easy, right? Like, sure. You're absolutely right. Government should be transparent. And so instead of making it hard and you need to do 27 things and get 20 turns on, push a button and publish it and make it as easy as possible. Whether it's a procurement process, whether it's that RFP process, make it open. Whether it's the budget, make it open. Whether it's how easy it is to make payments and I understand what I'm paying, make it open. And then the grants process. So it's really pushes us about transparency. And so we think a local community that's really leveraging our tools, they're going to have really easy workflows, very simple, controlled processes, really good data that they can use in decision-making. Because we don't just believe about controlling the data. We want to produce it and make it available in a way that enables elected officials, professionals to make decisions and good decisions for the community. And then let it all be transparent. And communities that are bought into that, that's what they get.
Yeah. Now, you do have an office here in Toronto. I think that's your Canadian headquarters. And your headquarter, the official headquarter, I think it's in Atlanta, correct?
Correct. Yeah. We're just outside from our own Oakville. But yeah.
Oh, in Oakville. I am in Mississauga, so it's don't throw away from you guys. How is the public sector in Canada and the US are different from each other? Do you know, or are they the same?
You know, I think for the most part, again, take the federal side out of it and really talk about the, you know.
Yeah, municipal and cities probably, province.
Yeah, province. Not a lot of difference. You know, some laws are different, obviously, but when I look at what we do, all of them have to produce budgets. All of them do fund accounting in those budgets. So that needs to be able to do that. There's usually workflows that tied to that. They have to get them approved by councils. They have to publish publicly procurements. There's RFP processes and there's contracts in Canada the same way there are in the US that you can work around that. You need to take payments. I would say US municipalities probably rely more on grants than Canadians do. Not that they don't exist in Canada. I think it's just more of kind of how the process works in the US. And so grants and grants management is a little more heavily influenced in the US.
Where does the grant come from, Tom?
Most of them come from the federal, almost all of them come from the federal government.
Oh, okay.
So it's the way the grant process in the US is one of the primary ways that the federal government passes money down to state and local municipalities. And it could be everything from education grants to art grants to public safety grants to, there's a big grant process in the US called community block development. And so it's really about how we're investing in infrastructure across the US and how the federal dollars get spread out across. And so all that stuff happens in Canada as well, but the way the process works is a little more intensive, I think, in the US.
And in Canada, probably the bilingual thing probably comes in your way, or how do you address that?
You know, Canada, we don't go to Montreal, right? We don't go to Quebec for that reason. One of the difficulties for us is because we have so much in the US and in Canada, the idea of, if you do any business, you know, in Quebec, right, everything has to be in French. And so your software has to be, your forms have to be, your tools have to be, all the laws are a little different in Quebec. They do like to be a little different.
Yeah, I do a lot of podcasting on, a lot of studies on Bill 96, so.
Yeah. So to this point, we've kind of stayed away. Mm-hmm. So we don't have any employees up there and we don't do any business with any of the municipalities up there. We've still got plenty to cover the rest of Canada. And so where the bilingual thing is not such an issue. We have some things in the US where we have some municipalities, you know, we're heavy Texas, heavy Florida, heavy California, where some have Spanish requirement for some forms, but they're a little more flexible in the US where you can use simple Google Translate tools and things like that, where it doesn't have to be so hard coded in.
And Tom, you got like 5 product lines. That's a wide portfolio. Like when you go to talk to a city or a municipality of sort, do they have to buy the entire package or how do you decide? Like, is there a consultation phase? How does that work? Which one do you decide to sell them?
Yeah, they do not have to buy the whole package. Obviously, we would like them to, and we think there's more value in that. But no, you know, usually the conversations start with something that they're looking for. So they come to us asking about budget or procurement or grants. You know, they're trying to solve a problem. I think when we go in and try to build relationships, we do just that, to build relationships, and we kind of can have conversations and see where their pain points are at. some of that's going to, you know, you go into some places and they're really advanced in some of the tools that they have in one group and woefully inept in another group from a tool perspective. And so we'll hone in on that and try to encourage them to catch up. But I'd say 90% of the time, it's really they're asking us and they're directing us at where their pain points are. And we go solve.
Yeah. So if they don't buy Una, for instance, like who are they buying? Who are they working with?
You know, we've got competitors. We got a set of competitors that are different based on the product line. But, you know, some will use, you know, their core ERP. So whatever their core accounting system, typically do some basic budgeting and some basic procurement. Not really great stuff. That's why we exist.
Not as specialized as Una, probably.
Yeah, not as specialized as us. There are, you know, OpenGov is a competitor of ours. Yeah. ClearGov is a competitor of ours. We do compete with Tyler, Central Square, some of the bigger, you know, public safety or public sector names. There's still people using spreadsheets. We still compete with Microsoft. Good old Office, believe it or not, which is, and I even to this day get surprised at times when, you know, a deal's coming across the table and I'm talking to the salesperson, asking them who the competition is who are we trying to unseat? And they're like, well, we're trying to unseat some spreadsheets. And it just still baffled me today, but there are still people using spreadsheets and stuff. So it's a mixed bag.
Spreadsheets. I'm laughing, but it's sad reality to be honest, but it's still there.
It is 100%. You know, and some of that is just it's understanding investment. It's understanding how to build ROI stories. Yes, there's some upfront costs, but you got to look at what the payback is, and it's usually pretty quick. And you know, there's some of that change fatigue or change resistance that exists in government on both sides of the table there, and so we try to help coach through that as well.
How hard is it to learn the software for somebody who's looking to change?
I actually think it's pretty simple. We're consistently looking at our user UI UX, using the software term, the user experience and what it feels like. And our goal is to make workflows as easy as possible. But we're starting to leverage some AI tools in the background to make it even easier so that you can have natural language conversations. You know, if I need to say, hey, I just create a line item, and I can just type create a line item instead of doing drop downs and things like that in a budget, or, you know, start an RFP, just type that instead of trying to do drop downs. And so we're always working on that. But in general, a lot of the people that we service, they've been doing the job for 5, 10, 15 years. So they know how to do their job. And so we do everything we can to match the way that our system works with the way they do their job. So heavy ability to configure workflows and steps and make those easy, really easy drop-down windows. We use language that they're used to, right? So budgeting terms and procurement terms, they can even change. A lot of places we have where they can change the language, not in English, Spanish, as in
I get it.
Term, right? And matching it. So we try to make it as easy as possible. And, you know, most people, our budget tool, you know, almost everyone in an organization touches the budget tool once a year. Mm-hmm. And our system is easy enough that most people don't need to be retrained. Even though they go in, they work in it for 3 days, they don't see it again for a year when they got to do it again. We do training up front when it goes in, and 90% of our customers don't call back for training again. So it's very intuitive and very easy to use.
Yeah, yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about the what I call the procurement problem, or broken procurement problem.
Yes.
And the reason I laugh is because I receive RFPs from government all the time. I work in the language industry, and I still see RFPs that have got nothing to do with the language industry except maybe a couple of paragraphs, and the rest of it is built for construction, I think, or some other thing. We want to build a highway, or we want to build a building of sort. And then we tag, you know, a couple of paragraphs at the top, maybe one in the middle about language, whatever you're trying to buy. Example, for instance, one recent one, it was an RFP for language services, and it was asking as a requirement for translators to wear hard hats. So there are a few out there customization that can be used. Now, I was just reading about, you know, some of the statistics you put out there in 2025. You know, 90 hours per RFP and only 2 to 5 bids in response. That's quite the gap. And this is generalizing, because I'm assuming you're taking that cross variety of stats here. From where you sit, and what is the root cause of all this? What is the root cause of this failure? And is it perhaps rewriting the process or writing the process in the system, or is it culture?
Yes, yes, and yes, yes. So I'd say there's a couple things right that are the problem. One is simply the culture, in as much as people are stretched, people are work. Like you get an average municipality in Canada or the U.S. There's probably one person managing all the RFPs, and on any given year, if there's a lot of investment being made, they're managing 10, 15, 20 RFPs. And like you talked about, the 90 hours. So 90 hours across 10, 15, like that's a whole year's worth of work. And it all usually gets consolidated down into whenever the budget year starts. So I've been saving up. I get my money. My money turns on October 1st or July 1st or January 1st, whichever budget cycle I'm on. I'm coming and I want to do it, right? And so a lot of pressure. And so the idea of these templates that they use, they just turn them out and they're not taking time to update them, right? And they're not taking they don't have the time, they're stretched or they're just not driving through it. I think the second thing that ties to that is also some of the limit to the 2 to 5 is actually just people's visibility. So one of our tools within our procurement system is called the UNA Supplier Network. And it's the way that people can see RFPs that are available. And to your point, some of them aren't written that well yet still. And so we've built some tools into the UNA Supplier Network that make it easier for you to understand, should you really apply for something? And should you see something and does it make sense to you? And so we're trying to really expand that out. And so that there is more competition and there is more people seeing these RFPs. And so, and then the third part of that is, how do we fix all that? And we've been, you talked about what we're releasing in terms of our generation. So helping to write RFPs within the system, helping to review things. So there's a review process now in our tool. So someone uses the template, like the thing you just described, and they tell the system, hey, this is for a language interpreter. And here's my RFP template that I filled out. It'll review it and come back and say, hey, you're asking for hard hats and you're asking for, you know, a surety bond.
Website developer,
and you're asking for a surety bond. Like, so we're trying to make the job easier. And next step that's kind of in a couple test customers right now is, not only does it flag it, then it makes recommendations for changes. And so it's taken that, again, using some really good strength tool things that AI are good at, right? Like, all right, yeah, that's a mistake. Here's a recommendation for you. Do you want to make this change? And it'll clean that up, like remove the hard hat requirement. And put this, you know, don't ask for these things. And so we're trying to take it where you don't need to worry about going through a lengthy process to update your templates. You don't have to worry about pulling the right template. Let the system do it for you.
Thomas, this is the solicitation advisor, right? Is this called the solicitation advisor, right?
Correct. And so really trying to make it so that talking back and forth, if you really leverage the system to its fullest, it's just like a conversation, you know, you're typing, but it's a conversation you and I are having, where the system's asking you questions and getting validation and asking you, what do you think about this, and getting validation so that you write a very crisp, clear, and easy to understand RFP document that will attract more people and will attract the right people. And then when you funnel that into our UNA Supplier Network system, where all the tags are written for you, all the understandings are written for you, and you put that out there, we're seeing people that we're averaging the 2 to 3 RFP responses. They anticipate getting, you know, 9 to 12. And so, and then, you know, letting the system help you record those. Some people get scared. I can't handle 12. Well, if you let the system kind of help you score it and do some things, you'll be okay. So we 100% agree with you. The process, we deal with the process on our side all the time. My biggest one that matches up with your hard hat is we do software, yet we get these language things put into contracts that talk about surety bonds and completion bonds. Like, well, there is no completion, and there is no, like, I don't understand. And no one can give me a bond. Like, no one would sell me a bond because it's software. There's no infrastructure.
Sure, yeah.
But someone's got a flag somewhere that goes in every single contract. And so we try to educate and we try to help and try to show to clean that stuff up.
One of the questions, probably the end, the listeners are thinking about right now, since we talk about AI tool that reviews an RFP, so the immediate question becomes, like, how are you training this AI model? Is it on specific customer data or is it general data? What's the odd of catching things accurately versus general?
Yeah, so the good news is 80% of what, you know, our system needs to be trained on is publicly available data. Again, back to the transparency
True. Most of public information is public information.
Public information is public information. And so we can get to within 80 to 90% just using public information and using the public models, you know, directed and trained around different criteria and tested. We are working with some customers now to allow us to use their data out of their system in an anonymized fashion. So, you know, it doesn't know that it's from the city of, you know, Toronto. It doesn't know certain things, but it knows kind of key criterias so that it can help, you know, train it a little tighter. And so we're continuing to add more and more customers who are willing to let us do that. But again, we get pretty good results just on the public available data. That's the good thing about the market and where we're going.
Now, some of the listeners out there may be interested in finding out ways to get on your suppliers network. How do they do that?
Yeah, best way is just to go to unisolutions.com. And if you look at products and search down, Unisuppliers Network's there, just click on that. It'll take you. It's really easy. It's a soft touch purchase, which means that you can go out and buy it with a credit card. You don't even have to ever talk to anybody if you don't want to. Or we definitely have some people that can help you. They can walk you through some of the finer features of the product and different ways to use it. But yeah, I'd encourage anybody that wants to sell to the government. It's incredibly cheap to use, and go out and give it a shot.
For the audience, if you're interested in hopping on to the Suppliers Network of UNI and you want to find out more or you want to connect with Tom and his team, let me know. By the way, Tom, I just sent you a connection request on LinkedIn. If you don't mind, it helps in the post-production too of this podcast, if you don't mind connecting with me. But I'll be happy to introduce any of our audience listeners to Tom and his team. Just send me a note on LinkedIn and I'll facilitate an introduction. Now, because your office is in Oakville and I've driven by it many times now, I don't feel like, what is this company again? Now I'm getting to know what this company does.
Yeah, now you know. Stop in and say hi.
We probably should say hello to a few people there. Yeah.
Yeah, we're a hybrid office environment, so we're in the office 3 days a week. There's some people that go in every day, but we're kind of Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We've got a full office every week, and I'm up there at least once or twice a month for the week. And
if you're ever here, let me know. I'm just literally a stone's throw away from your office.
Yeah, I'll do that. Be glad to meet face to face.
So you have DemandStar, which is now OpenBids. That's now the flip side of things, I guess. You consolidated like four acquisition in one buyer supplier network, basically.
Correct.
What did you learn from all this complexity of merging all these government procurement communities tools together? Like, was that easy, hard? How did you do it?
Yeah, you know, in some ways it was easy, some ways hard. The difficulty came in there were two different business models. One business model was that the government customer, so our direct customer, would pay us a fee. It was a license fee to use the product, and then they made it free for all the vendors to connect to. And the other model was, we'll charge the vendor a small fee and let it be free for the government agency. And so there was just the quintessential argument of what's the best model and how is the best way. Ultimately, the goal is to have as many vendors as possible and to have as many people seeing these things as possible, because that's what brings the competition in. That's what brings the value in. And so what's the best way to do that? And then the second thing was, each one of those had a different level of integration back to the procurement system. Some were very basic and had kind of my job is to only find people. My job isn't really to do some other stuff. And others like wanted really tight, and we're trying to build a flow where you as a vendor, you picked an RFP, you could pick it and then automatically launch into a response and build a response. And so again, what brings the most value and do that? So we kind of fought those fights, if you will, and did what you need to do and landed on some really good change. Technology wise, you know, again, everyone who builds a product builds it some differently. So we had to kind of pick and choose from there. I think the good news is all the people that we acquired hung around and helped us do it. Like, we didn't buy stuff and have everyone run. Like, we're really about partnering and bringing people in that want to be part of the vision. And so that made it a lot easier when we just kind of sold the vision, got alignment, and really moved forward together.
That's the best approach, because who better know the product better than the people that they're actually working with in the product to bring it in and glue it together to another solution?
You got it. 100%.
Now, let's move on a little bit to AI in the public sector, because that's an interesting point. I don't know like what you're seeing in the US, but what we're seeing here is a mixture of things, a mixed bag of things. Some people are apprehensive about it. Some people are scared of it. Some people don't want it because it removes jobs. Some people like just worried about information, variety of ways. If you open Google today, you'll find 20 different ways of rejecting AIs, and maybe you'll find equal amount of accepting AI. So you won the AWS Championship Award for AI Public Procurement. That's a pretty interesting one. But your own research says readiness is low, like in the from an AI adoption in government. How do you reconcile the, you know, being innovative on AI, but your customer's not ready, quite ready yet? What's the gap, and how do you bridge it?
Yeah, I think the reason we won that award, and the reason that we're often invited to speak and sit on panels and things like that, is that we're really about AI at the right pace, the right way. Like we're not trying to be bleeding edge. We're not trying to be out there and be crazy. We're not trying to do any of that. We do internally what we expect externally. So how we're using it in our business and leveraging it in the way that we work is we want to be able to talk to our customers and say, we're doing the same thing, right? We're leveraging a tool. We really think of AI as a tool, not a replacement. We don't want people to lose their jobs because we put AI in our products. We don't want a government official to be able to say, I'm going to go cut 20 jobs because AI can build my budget for me. No, what we want is we want to say that the quality of the budget, the depth of analysis, the ability to build out views that you were never able to build out before because you didn't have the time, you get the time back because of the use of AI. Some of the stuff we were talking about in procurement where it makes recommendations for you. Like it doesn't do the job for you, it makes recommendations. And it, again, one person trying to manage 12 RFPs across a month, it's just not possible to really do high quality stuff on all of them. So this is a tool that enables you to do that. So when we approach it, we data integrity first, data safety first, compliance with all appropriate state, local, federal regulations. And then really it's about how do we augment human activity, not replace it. Everything we do has human in the loop. Everything we do can be turned on, turned off. I think there was some appreciation for our thoughtfulness in understanding that governments are going to be slower to adopt. There are going to be hurdles that are different in every place you go. Canada, US, states in the US, provinces in Canada, they're all different. They all got different regulations. So we're very thoughtful in our design. We're very thoughtful in how we're putting things out there. And we think that we're taking the right approach. Currently, the kind of revolt against AI is happening with data center building. That's big in the
US. Yeah, I see that.
And so that's going to be something that impacts our customers. Like elected officials have to answer to the people revolting. And if they're putting too much AI in their products internally while their constituents are revolting, how's that going to balance? And so we try to be thoughtful. We try to be pragmatic about our approach. We try to be connected to our customers, moving at a pace that is appropriate for them, not too slow, but at the same time appropriate. And so that's what's won us the awards. And that's what we'll continue to do. We have several customer advisory panels across each one of our products. We have an AI specific panel that we're working with and getting feedback and getting input. We make sure that we're going to all the major conferences and sitting in the room and listening. We don't try to drive. We try to listen and make sure that we can really appropriately respond.
Now, I need to ask this question because it's a topic of conversation everywhere I go now, and every conversation I've had is it relates to governance. It's AI governance, but more on data residency and data sovereignty. What's your thoughts on that? And now that you're operating on both sides of the border here, Canada and the US, how do you view this?
Yeah, no, it's something that keeps our team up at night for a long time. Like it's just navigating it. Like we believe in our partners. AWS is our main partner, but we partner with Azure. We partner with Anthropic. We partner with OpenAI, and we believe in what they're putting in for us to protect. And then we've put multiple layers on top of that. I think probably the biggest thing is when we work with our customers to understand their requirements and their needs. We keep everything in the US, on the US side. And for our Canadian customers right now, those that are okay with things going to the US, we're totally transparent about that. And they tell us that it's okay if it goes to the US. If it's not, like there are some places where it's got to be stored in Canada. Now we store the data in Canada, but the data transits. So I think it gets really complicated, really technical, right? Data transit versus data storage. Like, all of our data for our Canadian customers is stored. AWS has Canadian presence. Azure has Canadian presence. So if you're one of those customers, that's where your data is stored. However, our language models that we use, both Anthropic and OpenAI, are US-based. We use the US-based ones. So if a Canadian entity is okay with data transiting down to get an answer and then transiting back, but not storing anything, then we're able to help them. If not, right now we're not turning those things on. We're waiting for somebody to open some things up in Canada. There are some models in Canada that we've tested that, quite frankly, just don't live up to the challenge of what we need. They're just not reliable enough. So, you know, so far, most of our customers have been okay with the transit model. And so as long as it's not stored and we can prove that it comes down and comes back, they're okay. But, you know, we're SOC 2 on everything that we do. We're working heavily with all of our security compliance modeling. We do not store data in the models, both internal, external. So it's only for computation and return. It does not get stored and all the typical things you'd expect to see. But I think that's going to be a bigger issue as it grows, because again, the data center issue, right? As data centers fill up, at some point, there's going to be potential risk where they're going to come and ask us, can we send data to somewhere, to here, to there, somewhere outside the continental US?
So that's the overflows.
The overflows, right? And so how are people feel about the overflows? Knocking on wood, I don't think any close to that yet, but it's going to come. And so we're looking ahead and trying to figure out some systems and some different things that we could potentially attack with that. But right now, you know, we just, again, it's about transparency. We're transparent with how we work. We're transparent with the tools we use. Security is at the top of the list.
So I'm assuming, by the way, what Tom is mentioning, data in transfer, that's called in Canada, data in transit and data at rest. Data in transit and data at rest, according to Canada, from a security perspective, needs to stay in the country and it has to follow certain encryptions. And to my knowledge, there is a couple of platforms in Canada that allowed for this particular kind of high level security, not with the inclusion of AI at this point. This is just from a processing perspective. Mm-hmm. And that would be the rated for what we call protected B. That's the classification of content in Canada. They're like the regular content, you call it reliable, if you will. They've got protected B, a little higher security, and you got top secret and NATO classification. So that classification, protected B, is now allowed on systems like Azure. I'm not sure if AWS is part of it, but definitely Azure, because there was a couple of white papers from Microsoft that describes how can you set up a protected B government approved platform using their Azure platform. So I'm assuming you already know that, but I'm just explaining it to the audience.
Yeah, 100%. And AWS has that opportunity as well. And that's where we service our primary customers.
Let's talk a little bit of down the road kind of thing. And, you know, taken from where you are right now, from a high level perspective, as a company, you're PE backed, servicing communities around the two countries, Canada and United States. I guess the two, between the two of them, I think the largest economies in the world. Those two things are not always easy to hold together because, you know, just from the view perspective, you've got a short-term PE approach to things. That's the ownership structure, I guess. But meanwhile, as a CEO, as a leader of the organization, you're thinking down the road, you think a long-term investment. Your customers are thinking that way. You know, I want to, you know, do a deal with you that's not like 2 years. I want to do a deal with you like 5-10 years. Most of your solutions are sticky solutions. Like when they go inside of an organization, it's very challenging to perhaps move on and bring somebody else because it requires many things. How do you balance these two things, the short-term objective versus the long-term objective of the market, the customer?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I'd say, one, this is where I give credit to GI as a partner. I think, you know, they've given us the very clear direction that we, myself, my leadership team, the whole company together, we should run the business the way the business needs to be run. And that means thinking, you know, I'm a big believer in the McKinsey Three Horizons model, right? That there's short-term, mid-term, long-term investments that need to be made. In technology in general, you've got to constantly be innovating. If you're not innovating, you're falling behind. And that takes investment, that takes dollars. And we have a ownership group who understands that. I think they understand that, you know, ultimately one day they'll want to sell us and they want to get maximum value when they sell it. A business that's not innovating, that's not growing, that doesn't have a plan for the future, that's not invested in the future, will get less of a return. The bottom line is when you sit across the table from someone who's going to buy a business, that buyer wants to know that the leadership team understands what they're doing. They've got a plan for how this next 4 or 5 years are going to go, that I'm going to own the business, and that we're not starting from scratch. This isn't made up stuff on paper. There's actually work being done. And so that takes investment and that takes work. And we have a team behind us that allows us to do that. So I tell my executive team all the time, you're never to make short-term decisions. Your job is to make long-term decisions always. If the board wants us to hold something, they can tell us that, but that's not how we operate. And our partners have been supportive of that. As a matter of fact, they actually ask us to spend more money sometimes and make some investments that we're not ready to make. And so it's been a good partnership from that perspective. But I'm a firm believer, whether I work in this business for another year, another 25 years, I'm going to make decisions, build plans, drive strategy that will pretend like I'll be here for 25, because that's the only way to do it.
And, you know, I agree with you at some point as a leader of organization, and I managed, the Canadian territory for the company I just left in end of 2025 after 25 years, got about 300 employees working in Canada here when I left. You got to focus on the business, and you can't let the other stuff, because too many things, too many balls in the air makes you get your eye off the ball and you end up not doing anything correctly, in my opinion, as I was a managing director here. So it was pretty interesting to see how, when you focus 100%, how your customers react. So there's the board, there's many other things going on there, but when you're focusing on your customer, your market customer sees that.
Yeah, I am, my job is to be that funnel, right? Like, I work with the board, their job is to think about the investment, their job is to think about when's the next thing that they need to do. And my job is to take the desires of that and then put it into a strategy and drive a long-term strategy and push that. I think you can look at it. One of the things I love about the fact of being private instead of public, I don't have to think about the immediate quarter every quarter. I can think about 6 months or a year. Like, this is going to take us a year to get here, right? This is a long range plan, and I don't need to worry about the stock price going up and down and needing to totally pivot and all that stuff, because that's dangerous. And particularly in technology, the kind of technology that we do. So I'm really happy to be with the partners we're with, and the board encourages us and expects us to be thinking long-term and push it that way. Cause that's short-term decisions. They might prop up a P&L for a little while, but they're going to ultimately damage the business.
Trust me, I used to listen in on shareholder meetings. Not fun.
No.
Not fun. Not at all. Sorry, I got to move on a little bit with the conversation, if you don't mind, Tom. My audience generally includes lots of company who sells to government. Obviously, I mean, we all want to sell to government. Government is viewed as the big behemoth that buys a lot. I mean, I'm pulling everybody together here, not single one. And the audience in my group, I guess, there'll be like translation agencies, localization vendors, language service providers, and many others, obviously software tool. And they'll probably all be very genuinely confused about the government procurement process. What is the one thing you wish vendors understood better about how government buyers actually make decisions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say two things. I think there's an assumption that it's always the lowest price wins. And so at times people either don't go after a bid because they don't think they'll be the lowest price, or they go in and they drop their price and they try to bid everybody. And while, yeah, there are certain things like a pencil, you're going to buy the cheapest pencil. But when you're buying a piece of software, when you're buying a professional service, like what a lot of your listeners do, when you're buying a partnership, price isn't always number one. So what matters is value and return. And so if you can go in and present extra value, and you're going to solve every problem point that's been described, and you're going to do it with high integrity, and you're going to do it in a really great partnering way, you don't have to be the cheapest price. And don't avoid going after an RFP or a contract. And also just don't try to dive to the bottom. Like, be you and be who you are. And then I say the second thing with it is have understanding that the government people do have to follow the process. Constantly asking them to break the process is not going to help you at all. Like, it's just going to frustrate the government, right? Like, it's okay to call and ask for updates, and it's okay to track where things are going, but don't ask them to break their process. You're asking them, and sometimes to literally break the law, and they don't appreciate that, because this is their job, right? And this is their protection. So understand the process, know it. If you don't understand it, ask and they'll tell you. But when you're in the process, follow the process and respect the process, and you've got a much better opportunity to build the right relationship.
So just to be clear, though, to your knowledge, there is no written law somewhere that says government has to buy the lowest price.
No, there's no law. Some small city somewhere may have that, but in general, it's not. I will say that 80% of the time, we're not the lowest price. I mean, you're not going to spend tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions, depending on the scale of what you're doing, right? More.
Yep.
But no, there is no law that says you have to be the lowest price.
And there's always that formula between quality and price.
Yeah, quality and price, 100%. And provision and return. So I will say one of the good things that's happened, call it over the last decade, it's been evolving, but governments have gotten much better at calculating a total ROI versus just a cost ROI, right? And so taking into consideration quality, taking into consideration partnership, taking into consideration support, taking into consideration in process change, and really layering in a lot of different factors that go into what my real return on investment is. And then it allows them to, price is a big part of that. It's a big part of the score, but it's not everything.
Now, let's pay attention a little bit to the public servant, or probably somebody listening to this conversation, you and me talking about government now. If a public servant listening right now, Tom, and they are deep in budget cycle and procurement process, what do you want them to hear?
Well, I want them to hear that if they're struggling through old software, if they're struggling through spreadsheets, if they're struggling through an inability to tell a story to their elected officials, UNA's a partner. And there are other partners, right? Like, listen, the GovTech community in general is a community of frenemies, right? Like we all,
let's go. Everybody knows everybody.
Everyone knows everybody. Put your best foot forward and the better man wins. And there is enough customers, there's enough business out there for everyone to be successful. If we're all, if we're all in it to make the customer better, there is plenty of work for everybody. And so I'd say, reach out to a partner. Don't be scared to take a meeting. Don't be scared to ask, how could we fix this? How can we make this happen? Don't be scared to change. And don't go home scratching your head. Why am I continuing to do this? Like, do something about it. Take that step.
And what kind of action item that you would like for the audience to do after this call? For instance, where can they follow your work? How can they get in touch with UNA, et cetera?
Yeah, I'd love to visit unasolutions.com. Follow me on LinkedIn, just Tom Amberge. There might be a few of them out there, but if you put Tom Amberge, UNA, you'll be able to find us. Follow UNA on LinkedIn, social media. We've got a lot of fun stuff coming up. There's a lot of big conferences coming up here, where we'll be presenting a lot of information. We've got case studies that are coming out, and keep up with us. And if you're in need of some software, let us know.
Thank you so much, Tom. I really appreciate this conversation. What do you think of this podcast so far? You've done two of them.
Yeah, no, it's been good. I love the question. Love your research. And hopefully we're helping to shine the light on a few things for people.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Tom Amberge, for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank the audience for watching us on YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube, or if you're listening to us on the podcast channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog post where I summarize this conversation in a short read, 2-3 minute read on robinayoub.blog, thanks for reading. Thanks for subscribing as well. If you enjoyed this conversation, if you think it's helpful to somebody, I hope you share it with somebody. And I hope we see you at the next episode. Until then, I wish you all the best. And I'll talk to you at the next episode. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Robin.